Hello, Jason DeRosso with you. Welcome to The Final Cut. This week, American director Sean Baker discusses his unorthodox and never boring romantic comedy, Tangerine, shot on a smartphone, and it looks great. But first, to Australian novelist, poet, and screenwriter Luke Davies, who you might remember adapted his own novel, Candy, for Holding the Man director Neil Armfeld back in 2006. It starred Heath Ledger and Abbie Cornish. Luke has now written the new film for Dutch director Anton Corbijn, who made A Most Wanted Man, The American, and Control. It's a movie that takes a roundabout route through the myth of James Dean via the photographer who helped immortalize him. It's called Life.
Just let me help you. I got 30 million people reading Life magazine. We do a great shoot. I mean, none of this stuff.
Wait a minute. You think you're giving me something that's not already coming my way? I lose myself in my roles. I don't want to lose myself in all this other stuff.
Right.
And you are this other stuff.
Well, you're not. Look, all I'm saying is I got some ideas, and you're not going to be thinking those things about me when you see the pictures.
All right, then give me one of your ideas.
All right. Where in New York makes you most happy?
All right, but you're not going to like it.
Show me.
Part biopic, part buddy road movie, Life unfolds with a grimness in a California that seldom looked this lackluster. And subsequently, it unfolds in the icy north of the country too. Perhaps because it's written by an Australian and directed by a Dutchman, it's a sideways glance at Hollywood, with two awkward, distrustful men at the centre. Robert Pattinson holds the film with a delicately brooding performance as Dennis Stock, a celebrity photographer for Life magazine. He's desperate to graduate from red carpet coverage and find a subject he thinks will show off his artistic eye, in part to validate his move out west, away from his ex-wife and young child who still live in New York. He sees his chance in a young, unknown actor named James Dean, played by a slightly mannered Dane DeHaan. On the eve of the release of East of Eden, Stock would follow the actor to old haunts in New York and the farm of his Quaker family, capturing some of the most iconic images of the young star along the way. This sounds like the premise for a gossipy, lively depiction of studio-era Hollywood and beat counterculture, what with a party hosted by Nicholas Ray and some bare-knuckle encounters with studio mogul Jack Warner, played by a menacing Ben Kingsley. And yet Life is surprisingly languid, even slow. I think the editor of the trailer knew this, and they've injected some uncharacteristically up-tempo music into that. The camera in this film, when it moves, avoids any Scorsese-like flourishes to evoke heady days, and the music is resolutely down-tempo, even when Dean jives to the jukebox with old friend Eartha Kitt in a New York bar. The scene struggles to express any excitement. Now, giving Corbijn the benefit of the doubt, and I'm not always sure he deserves it, this pacing issue at least serves to remind you that this is a simpler, slower time, not just for America, but for the characters themselves. The film also alerts us to the fact that this will be an internal film of small details, right from the opening scene in a darkroom that begins on a red globe that we can hear humming with electricity. If much of the film is a sombre backdrop, certain moments do shine brighter as a result. Watching how an uneventful afternoon in the rain transforms into the photo shoot that produced those images of Dean walking in Times Square, cigarette hanging from his mouth and collar turned up to the wind, is a thrill that creeps up on you. A reminder that art can stop time, and that people will give up so much, even their own happiness, to search for its transcendence. Life is more of a curiosity than an out-and-out success. But when it does work, it's because it is really a sincere love letter to the craft of photography itself. Anton Corbijn coming from that world, of course. Here's screenwriter Luke Davies talking on Skype from his home in LA, talking initially about his dealings with the British-Australian production house Seesaw Films.
I had a prior relationship with Seesaw Films from before they were called Seesaw. Emile Sherman and Margaret Fink were the producers of Candy, the film that I wrote that Neil Armfeld directed. And Emile went on to create Seesaw Films with an English guy, Ian Canning, and they made The King's Speech. So it was actually Ian Canning who came to me and said, you know, we did this big English thing, The King's Speech. We're thinking of doing something American. What do you think about James Dean? And I was like, he's, you know, James Dean is interesting. I understand that his iconic place in American cultural history, but I don't have much of an opinion or one way or the other. And he basically said, why don't you go off and read about him and see if there's anything there that's interesting.
Was this a little bit in the vein of the approach on the King's Speech in a way? Did they sort of suggest that, look, to do a Seesaw film, to do a Seesaw films on James Dean, we want to kind of find a peripheral character or a character that's considered thus far obscure in their life and sort of make a movie about their influence?
No, it was more broad than that, because it was me and my research who came across this small specific story about this peripheral character. So it was just something more general, the why don't you have a look at James Dean and see if you find anything there. And I did all this really general sweeping research, the whole life story of James Dean from birth to death. And I was relaying some of this stuff that I'd found to Ian. And then I said, there's this really interesting thing that happened, though. There's this guy who took the famous photo of James Dean in Times Square for Life magazine. His name's Dennis Stock. And they had this little road trip and went to New York and Indiana and took all these amazing photos. And Ian immediately said, that's the film.
Yeah.
So, and then those guys just gave me this great freedom to, you know, what I tried to write was a sort of philosophical buddy movie, or, you know, like a road movie about male friendship and that's tinged with mortality, with the sense that the audience knows that this famous character is going to die within 6 months after the events portrayed.
It seems a perfect fit for Anton Corbijn. Did you, I mean, given that his background is as a photographer, did you always have him in mind, or was it just a lucky sort of matchup?
It was a lucky matchup. I certainly didn't have him in mind. I don't think the producers did. They developed the script at the creative level with me without a director attached. And there was any number of possible directors who they were thinking of. But I think at some point Anton's name came into the conversation, and it was suddenly he was the one that everybody wanted, for the obvious reasons that his background was photography, and so he really related to Dennis Stock, the life photographer. Anton's career actually began when he took photos of a famous and beloved Dutch pop star who was kind of like the Dutch Bono or something like that. And later on that guy died. So Anton related to the story of the photographer seeing this iconic figure through his lens and becoming close to him and then losing him.
Are there any other similar relationships in the history of celebrity that you were thinking of, or indeed, are there any contemporary relationships between stars and particular sort of image makers, maybe even photographers, that you had in mind when writing this?
Well, the interesting thing that happened for me was when Ian Canning, the producer, the London producer, called me and said, maybe it's a good idea to think about your brief friendship with Heath Ledger in terms of the emotional energy that's coming out of writing this script. You know, because Candy, I wrote the novel and then I wrote the screenplay, co-wrote it with Neil Armfield. It was a largely or semi-autobiographical novel, so there's that weird way in which Heath was playing a version of me, and we got to know each other during that period of time of the shooting, and there was a closeness there. And so what Ian said was, you had this closeness with this guy who then died tragically, and that might be an interesting energy to draw upon in writing the script. And when he said that, I had not thought of that for a second, but it opened up a really interesting door for me in the writing of the script that took me to interesting places.
Candy was also a film, if I'm not mistaken, that was Heath Ledger at the point of his career where he was on the brink of breaking, you know, the big time. Tell me more about what you were tapping into then in that memory.
The memory was what I've tried to capture in the script, which was the personal, the intimacy and insecurity and vulnerability of the human being, Heath, in real life, or the James Dean character in the script, and the thing that was happening to him, which was the fame machine. You know, Heath had just shot Brokeback Mountain, came to Australia, shot Candy, And then basically everything began to explode for that final 18 months or 2 years or 2.5 years, whatever it was, and the Joker and so on. James Dean, at the moment that the Life magazine came out with the photos in it that Dennis Stock had taken, and the title was Moody New Star.
I love that title, by the way. It's so prosaic.
Yeah. That issue of Life magazine came out, and 2 nights later was the world premiere of East of Eden at the Astor Theatre in New York. And instantly James Dean went from being just another struggling actor who'd done a few half-hour TV episodes on bad American 50s TV to the biggest new star. And it wasn't so instant with Heath. I think he already had substance, but there was that period of a year or two when everything changed for him and would have continued to change. Yeah, so for me it was about the amazing sweetness of Heath Ledger, the person, the sweetness and openness and all that stuff, all that paparazzi ugliness was just these attempts to construct drama where it didn't actually exist. And it was horrible to see that stuff and his distress about it. He wasn't playing the game or complicit in his own connection with all of that world. He was kind of deeply private person and scared of all that. And I definitely tried to create some of that in James Dean. And in all the biographies that I read, that stuff was there too, the conflicted relationship between the real person, the creative artist, and the putting on of a show that seemed necessary to play the game. And that's what the big Jack Warner scene is in the movie, with Ben Kingsley playing Jack Warner, is about Jack Warner, the head of Warner Brothers, saying, you got to do things this way. This is how it's going to work. You have to behave.
Screenwriter Luke Davies. Life, the film, is out now. On RN, you're listening to The Final Cut, Movies on the Radio, with me, Jason DeRosso. And there's some strong language ahead.
Cindy's back on the block?
Oh, yeah, she's back. She's back and she's going hard.
Merry Christmas, bitch.
Woo! I got some good news to tell you about me and Chester.
I know what it is.
You're breaking up with him. Thank God.
I'm going to be cheating on you like that.
Wait, what?
You didn't know?
White boy.
Who is she?
Her name starts with a D.
Danny.
Desiree.
Destiny?
You're making me lose my game.
She's some white fish.
Chester, did she know me with real fish?
Yeah, bitch, like a real fish. Girl, like vagina and everything.
Girl, calm the fuck down. It's not that serious.
I will go with you under one condition. You must promise me that there's not going to be any drama.
I promise.
Look at me in my eyes and promise.
I promise no drama, Alexandria.
When American director Sean Baker was here for the Sydney Film Festival earlier in the year, you may have seen him do various media interviews, most of them interested in the angle that he shot his film, Tangerine, with a smartphone. While this is undoubtedly an important aspect of the work, it's by no means the only thing that makes this movie remarkable. Bursting with the kind of personality you get when you hit casting gold, Tangerine is a giddy farce, set in LA on Christmas Eve, about a pair of transgender hookers, Cindy and Alexandra, played by Katana Kiki Rodriguez and Maya Taylor, and two unreliable lovers, a low-level drug dealer, James Ransoni, who it appears is cheating, and an Armenian taxi driver, played by Karen Karagoulian. The film ducks and weaves through a series of street-level vignettes and escalating crises. Baker saturates the colours of the smartphone's crisp, wide-angle images to conjure a delirious street-level portrait of a city that transforms from tangy sunset to neon and fluorescent nighttime. And he even manages to insert a Christmas message of love that somehow makes it to the finish line, if a little punch drunk. Tangerine is recommended.
Hey, Alexandra, come here. Listen, have you seen Cindy?
Cinderella. Looks like someone has a crush.
Tell me about shooting it on an iPhone. Was it because it was just a cheap way to shoot a movie, or was there something about setting yourself an artistic challenge formally with the equipment?
Well, I would love to say that it was all about the aesthetic, but
quite honestly, it really came down to the fact that we'd had no money. We had very little money. And we eventually accepted it and embraced it and made our own aesthetic from it. But the way that we basically had to do this because of the lack of funds.
And does this mean you were only using the standard iPhone lens as well?
Yes, the lens, which we're using the lens on the iPhone. But
so it's a semi-wide angle lens, isn't it, really?
Yes, it is. It is. But there, we found this adapter created by this company called Moondog Labs that fits over the lens. And what it does is that it allows you to shoot in true scope. So we're actually shoot, which is a widescreen aspect ratio. And so that really is one of those tools that elevated it to a cinematic level for me. And it's one of the tools that really was a deciding factor in us moving forward shooting on the iPhone.
But it meant you still weren't able to obviously swing lenses and use different sort of...
We are locked at a focal length that we could not change. But which is great because, you know what,
it works well on the street, I think.
It works well because I come from this school of social realist filmmaking, and I really love the aesthetic of social realist filmmaking, but I had to break it because of this with this movie. I had to break that aesthetic. Number one, we couldn't shoot with telephoto lenses. Usually when you make this sort of movie, you shoot with telephoto lenses as if you're observing this from across the street. Well, with this, we were forced to get up in our actors' faces, and that really... it's one of those happy accidents. We were forced to become much closer in with our characters, but I think ultimately that helped out the film so much, especially with the subject matter that we're dealing with. I didn't feel as if this was a National Geographic, observational film. Instead, we were participating with these characters in their story, in their chaos of this day that they're going through. Not only that, there was something else. The other sort of style that comes across with these social realist films, and I'm talking mostly about like the British social realist films that have had a major influence on me, they tend to drain the color. There's something that we as audiences associate with drained color with reality. We say, okay, the lack of saturation means reality. Well, in this case...
Because reality is drab,
I
right?
Guess so. But in this case, we went the other way. These characters... were so colorful, and this world is so colorful that in post-production, I did the opposite. I pushed the colors to the roof, and I think that really helped out as well.
The trans women in the film, they're actually real people,
yes.
Non-actors.
Right.
How did you?
Well, I say first-time actors.
First-time actors. Yeah. That's you're right to point that out because they're very good on screen here.
Yeah.
Tell me about what they brought to the project, what they brought to the experiences they bring even to this script, and how you sort of met them.
Sure. Well, I'm not from that world whatsoever. And so with all of the films I make, if I'm exploring a world in which I'm not part of, I always say the most responsible and respectful way of doing it is to collaborate. So when I went into that world with my co-screenwriter, Chris Bergosh, we didn't come in imposing a script on them or a plot. We said, let's work together and figure something out. And I found, after introducing ourselves to many women in the area and just people who were inhabiting that corner of Santa Monica and Highland in Los Angeles, I eventually found Maya Taylor at the LGBT Center. She was there with some friends one spring morning. This is like around the corner from the hub that we shot at.
And this is a key congregation point for the prostitutes of the area.
The corner is, but the center.
Not the center. No, I didn't mean to say the
exactly.
center.
Yep. So the center where Maya was hanging out, we saw her in the courtyard, and there was just something about her, this aura, this, that it factor. There was something that drew me in about 40 feet away. I had to talk with her, her physicality, the way she held herself. I approached her, told her what we were doing, what we were planning on doing, and she just expressed this huge amount of enthusiasm. She was an aspiring entertainer herself. So we started hanging out. We started hearing her stories, anecdotes, stories of the women that she knew who worked the area. And then eventually she brought Kiki to the table. One day during our sit down that we would have at the local fast food joint, she brought Kiki in. And as soon as I saw Kiki sitting next to Maya, I knew that we had a dynamic duo on our hands. They complemented one another. They contrasted one another. They were just a great pair. And we then just said, let's figure out the script together. And we all collaborated and came up with this thing.
You've shot both in New York and LA, and you now live in LA, but I think you're raised in New York, or at least had your sort of formation there. You studied at New York, New York University and stuff.
I spent most of my life in New York, actually. I fell out of it. Got out of love with it.
How do you find the two cities, I guess, well, on two levels, personally, but also as a filmmaker?
Well, to tell you the truth, there seems to be this exodus going on. And I see all these independent filmmakers coming out to LA, and there's this nice little community that's growing. And my hope is that, you know, the collectives that were around in the 60s and, you know, the 70s, early 70s, I would love that to see that happen, where we support one another and there's more collaboration. That would be amazing. I could see that happening. But
imagine this space in LA, you know, just kind of mentally.
Exactly. There's so many neighborhoods, so many subcultures. When I came to LA, I just assumed that everything was shot out. You know, the term shot out, meaning it's when all the locations have been used up by the studios. But that's so not true. When you actually go to LA, you realize that there's an entire city below Pico Boulevard, south of Pico, that runs for, 16 miles, 17 miles to Long Beach. There's so much that hasn't been explored. And then there are all these beautiful cities just outside of LA. And there's, you know, the desert cities and the Salton Sea down in the San Diego County. And just wonderful locations that haven't really been exposed and exploited.
Filmmaker Sean Baker, Tangerine is releasing around the country. Equally delirious, but anything but low budget, is the new film from master Hong Kong director Johnny To, a musical about Chinese capitalism called simply Office. Set in the aftermath of the Lehman Brothers collapse, it unfolds inside a corporation on the eve of an IPO float, as it also prepares for a new partnership with a Western cosmetics giant. But really, this is about the difficult lives and loves of the characters inside this firm. From the very top of the food chain, where veteran star Chow Yun-fat plays a corporate captain who's having an affair with his CEO, Taiwanese actress Sylvia Chang, who wrote the play on which this film is based, to the bottom of the food chain and a couple of interns, played by the fresh-faced Wang Zhiyi and the enigmatic Tang Wei. Themes of corruption and ambition will be recognisable to anyone familiar with Johnny To's stylish, brutal gangster films, movies like the Tarantino favourite Election or Drug War. But Office is also a sugary confection. Remember, Johnny To also directs rom-coms. There are jaunty musical numbers and a beautiful abstract set design of shimmering gold and lush turquoise that reminds you of a television game show. Glowing lines intersect and dramatic curves sweep through the frame to form the contours of doors and windows and staircases against an infinite blackness. Giant clocks loom overhead, reminding us that time is money, while luxury cars, jewellery and high-end tailoring show us the glittering spoils of capitalism. At times, there's an echo of the film Playtime, Jacques Tati's stylized vision of office life and modernity. Only here, in the postmodern world of unfettered global capital, the absence of a horizon line, coupled with Cheng Sui-kyung's roaming camera, suggests a world without limits, where old structures are no longer relevant. Or are they? There is a price to be paid, it would seem, for all this ambition and vanity. And even if some of the song numbers that pepper the movie don't quite capture the full force of the emotions in the film, lust, betrayal, regret, love, there's so much that Johnny To does capture of this historical and geopolitical moment with his neurotic and flawed characters. Office is an arresting fresco of the moral dilemmas at the commanding heights of modern-day China. It's also one of the most beautiful films of the year. It's on 12 screens around the country in most capital cities. You should run to see it. And that's The Final Cut. I'm Jason DeRosso. See you next week.